At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Tony Bruschi. Welcome. We hope you've enjoyed our coverage on the trial of Alec Murdaugh. This is a look back at some of the key moments and conversations that we've had over the last several weeks regarding the case.
This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us today. We're talking the Alec Murdaugh case with former Deputy District Attorney and experienced Alameda County criminal defense lawyer, Lewis Goodman. Lewis, welcome to the program. Great to have you back. I want to talk about all of the information that has been coming out in the case and now presented to the jury, the judge saying that this is important, that they have some connections here, have some context, if you will, into the financial crimes of Alec Murdaugh, because it does seem to possibly link into the murder case as well, possibly as motive. Obviously something that is not required to be connected or presented, but is something that juries definitely are looking for. What are your thoughts on all of this being displayed right now? And one could argue that they are two different crimes. Just because you stole millions of dollars doesn't necessarily make you a murderer per se.
Tony, as you know, motive is not an element of any crime. Mm-mm. But jurors want to know what the motive is. Once jurors, and for that matter, the public, has their first question answered. The first question is, who did this? Mm-hmm. The second question is, why did this person do it? Interestingly, it's been my experience that people who are charged with crimes tend to get charged with the same crime over and over again. So thieves get charged with thefts, and DUI drivers get charged with drunk driving, and domestic violence people get charged with domestic violence, and usually you don't see a lot of crossover. Mm-hmm. In this situation, I think that that motive question is answered by looking at the other things that this individual has done in his life, which has to do with the illegal grabbing of money that's not his.
And context to me is always important. I know in court, sometimes it's, let's just keep this narrow focus. We're only looking at this specific crime. We don't need to know about all these other things. And obviously that's been what the defense of Murdaugh kind of wanted to have keep happen. However, that's not the way it goes. Is this, I mean, obviously it's detrimental to the defense, but was it called for? Is it appropriate that all of that information be given to the jury to make a better decision on his fate? Again, obviously motive not required, but it certainly does paint one.
defendants, generally speaking, don't want more information about their past lives to come into evidence because it's generally used against them. And in this case, that's precisely what's going on, is the prosecution wants to show that motive. And in doing so, they want to bring in prior acts of bad conduct. And the evidence codes, generally speaking, do allow for evidence of prior conduct to come into evidence to show modus operandi or how the crime is committed. Now, in this case, it's not so much that the prior theft offenses go to show how the murder was committed, but it does very much go, as we just mentioned, to showing motive. And I think that it'll, if the case ends up with a conviction and there is an appeal, the judge's decision to allow this bit of evidence in may very well be a grounds for appeal. And then we'd have to see what the appellate courts think in terms of whether the judge's action was appropriate or not. But the jury is certainly going to hear about it, and I think the jury is going to find that bit of evidence very interesting.
Is that a tough decision for a judge to make, knowing that adding this in is probably appropriate, so they do have context, but also knowing that the likelihood of him being convicted is there, and then almost creating an out for him to appeal?
I think you have to look at it from the judge's point of view, which is no judge likes to be reversed. On the other hand, I think that judges tend to say, what do I really think is the right thing to do at this time? And if some other judge says that I made a mistake, so be it.
If there were to be an appeal, and in almost any case like this, would there not be an attempt to make some sort of appeal if found guilty?
There's going to be an appeal. If
yes.
he's found guilty, there's going to be an appeal. There is no doubt about it. In a case like this, there will be an appeal. There's no reason not to have an appeal.
How easy is it then for that appeal to be turned down? How does that process work for our audience?
Well, I can't speak specifically to the Arkansas. Well, it's not Arkansas.
I'm in Arkansas. This is South Carolina.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I can't speak specifically to the South Carolina appellate process, but generally speaking, they tend to work the same. And the question is going to be whether the judge made a mistake, and the appellate court may very well say, no, the judge didn't make a mistake. The judge was well within his rights to allow this bit of evidence in. And if so, that ends it there. The other possibility is that the appellate court could say, well, the judge made a mistake letting it in, but it is not a sufficiently erroneous decision so that it would require overturning the case. It's referred to oftentimes as harmless error. And I think that also people need to understand there's basically only three reasons that a case gets overturned. Mm-hmm. The judge makes a mistake. The prosecutor makes a mistake with some sort of prosecutorial misconduct. The defense attorney makes a mistake by providing ineffective assistance of counsel. And virtually every criminal case that's appealed, all three of those issues are raised.
How easy is this to get this appealed from what we know thus far and what's come out to be successful in an appeal? Obviously, anyone can request that, but for it to actually happen and for it to get another shot at court in a retrial, is there much likelihood on something like this?
It's really hard to say, and I don't even like to discuss the appellate process until there's actually a conviction.
Sure.
But appeals are for losers.
Sure. It's the case that I can think of where the appellate court granted the new trial would be The one, remember the staircase? Did you follow that one at all?
A little bit. I mean, yeah. I have some familiarity with it, but sure. I mean, you know, appeals are granted all the time. It's not unusual, but I would say that in the vast majority of appellate cases in the criminal realm, the verdicts are upheld.
Okay.
And then it goes to the next level of appeal. So for example, if there's a, you know, there's a South Carolina Court of Appeal, and then the appeal from there would go to the South Carolina Supreme Court. That's a court that is of limited jurisdiction, and they can decide what cases they want to take and what cases they don't want to take, similar to the United States Supreme Court. They choose what cases they take. And it's unusual for them to take a case, you know, where there's a guilty verdict, the Court of Appeal is denied any sort of appellate remedy, and then for them to take the case unless there's some real issue of great public import and policy usually.
I'm curious to get your take on the gunshot residue, the GSR, that was found on a blue poncho-like raincoat found in September at Murdaugh's mother's home in Elmira, in Hampton County. A witness in the Murdaugh family caregiver, Michelle Smith, testified that she saw Murdaugh walk into the home roughly about a week after the killings carrying that blue vinyl object, as it's been presented, which in where the raincoat was later found. Fletcher later testified that there were 38 confirmed particles of GSR, with many other particles possible but unconfirmed located on the inside of the rain jacket, two particles found inside the hood of the coat, at least one on the outside, one particle of GSR found on Murdaugh's seatbelt. Murdaugh's defense team cross-examining today on that. And obviously we're sitting here talking, so I'm not watching and seeing exactly what's happening at this moment. But if you were to prepare to cross-examine on behalf of Murdaugh today, are there any holes you feel you can poke into that amount of evidence relating to the gunshot residue?
It was a day or two ago, you had a firearms and ballistics expert on. And one of the things that he said was, you know, a shell casing doesn't make the case. Mm-hmm. You need to put it in context with other bits of evidence. And I would say the exact same thing with respect to the GSR. And I don't claim to be some kind of a firearms expert, but you know, that gunshot residue could have gotten on that jacket any number of ways. He could have gone to the range and taken his gun out to the range and shot it. If he lives in a rural area, he could have taken out behind his barn and shot the gun while wearing this particular coat. Mm-hmm. So that piece of evidence as an individual evidence item is of little import. But if you put it together with several other pieces of evidence tending to show that that he used a gun, a particular type of gun at a particular time, wearing a particular bit of clothing that you could then hook up to something else, then it becomes an important part of the mosaic.
Mm-hmm. And that ends up putting the pieces of that puzzle together. Another piece of the puzzle that we've heard testimony from witnesses is the voice of Alec Murdaugh on tape on a TikTok recording that Paul was going to be sending out to a friend while he was taking care of his dog. You hear Paul, you hear Maggie, and then you hear a third voice that sounds like Alec Murdaugh, and many people testifying saying 100% that is him, although he does not appear on camera. How strong is that testimony to have multiple people from former colleagues to friends and such say, yes, this is him, but we don't have his face on camera at the time, right before the murder, where he said he was not?
Well, it certainly doesn't help the defense any.
No.
I think that that's the kind of thing where jurors will probably say, yeah, I'm willing to listen to other people say whose voice they think it is. But ultimately, I think it's the kind of thing where jurors are going to make their own decision based on listening to that voice for themselves against some known sample of the defendant's voice.
Lewis Goodman, former deputy district attorney and experienced Alameda County criminal defense lawyer. Thank you so much for your insight on the Alec Murdaugh case. Greatly appreciate that. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we are following for you every single day. You can even get a commercial-free experience if you sign up through Apple Podcasts right now. You get a commercial-free experience of all of our shows and all of the stories and cases that we are following for you. You can follow me on Twitter at TonyBPod. Until next time, for all of us here, I am Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.